Over the years, we've had speakers from South Africa, Asia, Eastern Orthodoxy. Today, it is our pleasure to discover just what is the distance between Lancaster and Akron. Akron, Pennsylvania, that is. And if you read the paper this morning, on the front page, we will see that there may be a difference. But I am told by many that the distance is getting shorter and shorter. Our speaker is John Lapp, the executive director of the Mennonite Central Committee. He was educated at Eastern Mennonite College, Western Reserve University, and holds a PhD in history from the University of Pennsylvania. His career has alternated between teaching, administration in schools, and also work abroad and traveling, and now with the Mennonite Central Committee. He taught at Eastern Mennonite College and at Goshen College, was dean and provost at Goshen, and then after many travels has returned to the Mennonite Central Committee. His life is indeed an engagement between faith and the practice of ministry, between the gospel of peace and the divisions of the world, and the way in which Christians can witness in a changing world. The title for his lecture is quite appropriate and just the title that we would expect, Taking the Form of a Servant, the Practice of Mission in the New Church Order. Will you welcome John Lapp?
Thank you very much, Peter. It's good to be with you, faculty, students, friends of Lancaster Seminary. It's a great honor for me to be chosen to be the 1995 Gregory Lecturer on International Missions, and I pray that God will be honored with what I say and that the cause of God will be enhanced. As a sometime historian, I'm always eager to see the connections between peoples and their traditions. And while the Mennonite and the Reformed tradition have had their disagreements, there have also been wonderful moments of mutual affirmation and support. And I want to begin by telling a story that's germane to this lecture. Last summer, the Mennonites of this community celebrated the 100th anniversary of the mission movement in the Lancaster Mennonite area. In September 1894, several talented young men, and it was men in those days, formed the Mennonite Home Mission Advocates. And I suspect that they felt some of the same energy that was emanating from this seminary and from Franklin and Marshall College in those decades. It was only a few years before 1894 that an F&M graduate from my home community of Souderton in Montgomery County, Henry Gerhard Appenzeller, went to Korea as one of the main organizers of the Mennonite Church there, of the Methodist Church there, not Mennonite. One of the members of the Home Mission Advocates was a person named Jacob Ressler. He was one of the first Mennonites to graduate from Millersville State Normal School, and he became the first appointed Mennonite Church overseas missionary. Some months after arriving in Bombay in March of 1899, Ressler and his two colleagues, Dr. and Mrs. Page, decided to establish the American Mennonite Mission, as it was called, in Dumtree Central Provinces, now Madhya Pradesh. Dumtree is 50 miles south of Raipur, then the mission center of the Evangelical Synod, soon to become part of the ENR Church, which you know so well. Ressler and Dr. and Mrs. Page spent from August to November 1899 living with the Evangelical Synod missionaries, Stoll and Goss, and their families, learning Hindi and how to do mission work. These were Mennonites who had never been involved in any kind of overseas mission, and it was these people who taught them how to do it. These Raipur friends even went further and loaned permanently several families to work with the Mennonites in establishing orphanages and a church in Dumtree. 1 year later, in 1900, Stoll and Goss oriented two General Conference Mennonite missionary families, the Penners and the Krakers, before they established a field 50 miles to the north of Raipur in Champa. On this occasion, I'm delighted to recall those wonderful acts of ecumenical support and assistance. And from then to now, the churches in Raipur, Dumtree, and Champa have had warm relationships. Together, they have been a persistent, sometimes heroic, witness to God's love for the world. As you well know, modern ecumenicity has had its roots in the mission movement. And Raipur, Dumtree, and Champa can continue to be instructive to us in Lancaster County. As Peter's indicated, I've entitled my remarks, Taking the Form of a Servant, the New Church Order, and the Practice of Mission. It's a very big topic, and I can only sketch out a few themes. As I thought about the issue of international mission, I kept coming back to issues that occupy me as an administrator of Mennonite Central Committee. These are issues that are not only unique to us, however. They're issues that are on the desks and the tables of all mission agencies and any church-related relief and service agency like Mennonite Central Committee. Within the past 18 months, three of our area desks have prepared statements on what it means for them to relate to local churches where they work. One for Africa, one for Southeast Asia, another for Central America. And at our forthcoming April board meeting, we will be spending a half a day considering those three statements and what they say to the whole program of MCC. And so that's why I'm driven to think about the practice of mission and the whole question of church relations. I want to assume this morning that all of us have some understanding of and a commitment to the biblical story as one of mission. God's fundamental purpose is to reconnect with all parts of the created order. Abraham and Sarah were called to create a family, a people, who would bless all the nations of the earth. The prophets and Jesus renewed and extended the universal dimensions of God's invitation. And Jesus announced the coming of the kingdom, invited the people of Galilee, Samaria, and Judea to follow the way, and then concluded, "As you have sent me into the world, so I send them into the world." Mission is God's desire to save the world. In the words of David Bosch, the mission of the church, as the mission of Jesus, involves being sent into the world to love, to serve, to preach, to teach, to heal, to serve, to save, and to free. Mission is not only about the gaining of adherence to the Christian cause. In the words of Andrew Walls, mission is also about the penetration of a culture and penetrating ways of thinking with the word of Christ. Mission is the word becoming flesh again and again and again. While mission is intrinsic to being good news, there are always problematic dimensions. There are fundamental questions about relationships to diverse cultures, to other religions, to the socio-political context. When Henry Appenzeller left Pennsylvania for Korea in 1885, he announced that his goal was, I quote, "to take the country for the Lord Jesus Christ." His recent biographer, Edward Portress, observes how difficult it is for us in the 1990s to accept, and I quote, "such robust, assured, triumphalist, unselfconscious attitudes towards our culture and that culture." But alas, such attitudes, unhappily, continue to permeate many mission enthusiasts. Last fall, I spent several days in South Sudan. We were told that the fastest growing Christian churches in the world during the past decade are in that rebel-held territory. In 1984, 85% of the people who belonged to the Dinka tribe belonged to African traditional religions. In 1994, 85% had accepted Jesus as their Savior and Lord. A remarkable statistic. And most of these people are now members of Anglican and Catholic churches. But there's a major political dimension to this story, as South Sudan is engaged in a long struggle with the Islamic central government. And even being aware of that, I was still startled to read in the Manchester Guardian Weekly several weeks ago these words from a report by John Hulain. The Sudanese rebellion also has the unwavering support of Christian non-governmental organizations, which see southern Sudan animist and Christian communities as Africa's last bulwark against Islamic terrorism. And they were hard words for us to read at Akron, so close to Lancaster, for we at MCC would have to be considered as one of those Christian NGOs. There are many other illustrations of the problematic in Christian mission. It is interesting to me, for instance, that in spite of the Roman Catholic capacity for dialogue across confessional lines, the Buddhist leadership of Sri Lanka boycotted John Paul II on his visit there to their country just 2 months ago. Interfaith issues continue to be an important agenda item for every Christian mission. Now I must hasten to the announced topic. I want to first talk about the new church order and then the practice of mission. 5 years ago, as you all know, President Bush announced a new world order. He was not very convincing, in spite of the significant events of the past decade. But of a new church order, I have no doubt. I want to begin with the Mennonite situation. A year ago, the Mennonite World Conference, our most authentic global structure as Mennonites, announced for the first time in our 470 years that more Mennonites live in Africa, Asia, Central and South America than live in Europe and North America. 519,000 in the South, 450,000 in the North. In 1900, there were only about 250,000 Mennonites, and all of them lived in Europe and North America, just a few in Indonesia. Today, there are more Mennonites in Zaire than in Canada, more Mennonites in Ethiopia than in all of Europe. The Pennsylvania Dutch stereotype is now an anachronism. The majority of global Mennonites are black and brown. Now, this is a microcosm of the global church situation. In 1900, there were about a half a billion, 500 million Christians in the world. 95% of them lived in Europe or in the Americas. Today, there are 2 billion Christians in the world, and 55% of them live in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Now, numbers in themselves are not always that significant, but the proportions are, as well as the character of the population group. Whereas we in the North and the West, implicitly, if not explicitly, have thought of ourselves as, in some sort of Christian terms, now we have to recognize that other places may have a stronger hold on that adjective than we have. The majority of Christians in the world today are people of color. In most situations, they are desperately poor and powerless in terms of global political and economic structures. 2 weeks ago, a Baptist pastor in Managua, North Nicaragua, told me that three of his 45 church members had remunerative employment. The Christian church around the world has virtually the same proportions of hungry and destitute people as in global statistics. In spite of these, of their considerable numbers, Christians are often a minority in their own locality, not unlike the increasing reality of the church in the West, where we are also more and more minorities within our own culture. It's in such a situation of this transition to the majority Christian world being in the South rather than the North that the distinguished Christian African scholar Laman Sana asked this question: how do we in North America prepare ourselves for entry into the world, into the realm of world Christianity? How do we, as North American Christians, prepare ourselves for entry into the realm of world Christianity? The question, Laman Sana says, is whether mainstream Western Christianity in its Protestant, Orthodox, or Roman Catholic forms, as it emerges from its deep assimilation in the heritage of the Enlightenment, whether this tradition is capable of joining hands with world Christianity framed by radically different plausibility structures. My interest this morning is not to pursue Sana's exploration of the intellectual and the theological task. That's terribly important, and I hope you're about it here in the seminary. Rather, I want to highlight the more practical question of how powerful, rich churches relate to powerless, poor churches who now represent the majority of the Christian population. From my vantage point of leading a North American church agency relating to numerous poor churches on all the continents save Australia, I think this is the critical issue if we're really going to become global Christians and become a global church. Now, there are many stories that can be told to describe the problem. Last summer, many of us were preoccupied with the turmoil in and around Rwanda. As a duty-bound administrator, I did my tour last October. The most poignant moment on this trip, however, was not in the refugee camps, but in the headquarters of the All Africa Council of Churches. There I was told of the anger, the disappointment, the depression that permeated this important ecumenical church structure that was all but ignored as church and parachurch agencies moved through Nairobi to Rwanda, Burundi, and Zaire without as much as paying a courtesy call or asking for counsel from the African church leadership. And Anglican and Roman Catholic bishops confirmed the same experience of being bypassed in a similar manner. To top it off, on my last day in Nairobi, a well-meaning European who did stop by noted that since Africa had obviously failed in Rwanda, his peace and reconciliation group would have to establish a base there. And my African friend noted that there was no irony, as this European did not talk about the European failure in Bosnia and Herzegovina. In the new church order, there are no longer any open spaces. The church is present in some form in every nation. And to ignore or bypass the local church is to make a statement that it is unimportant, or at least not as important as those of us who come in from the outside are. And those of us from denominational societies, like North America, need to exercise special care that we do not fragment the Christian witness or give cause to what the New Testament called the scoffers. Ecclesiology has always been integral to missiology, but especially these days in the search for a new church order. In taking Laman Sana's question seriously, North American Christians not only have to find new plausibility structures, but also new behaviors. We have enormous economic, organization, and cultural power, if less political authority. And the new church order requires new patterns of relationships, new levels of respect, and a deliberate restructuring of our world outlook and church-to-church relations. The place to begin, I believe, is in the practice of mission. And so to my second point, the practice of mission. The French Catholic missionary, Bernard Jonier, has written a wonderful paragraph describing his groping for what it meant to be a missionary in Tanzania in the 1960s. And I quote, "I grew up in the church and was trained in church schools. When I volunteered for foreign service, the church gave me the further training they thought necessary. Looking back on it now from Tanzania, I have to confess that my church experience and my missionary training led me to visualize the mission enterprise as a bus, a large church bus, for which I was being trained to be the driver. When I arrived on the field, however, to my chagrin, I found that the indigenous church had plenty of people who knew how to drive. In fact, the potential drivers were jostling among themselves to get a chance at the wheel. Instead of welcoming me with open arms, they let me feel that they viewed me as a foreign intruder. In utter dismay, I retreated to the farthest corner of the mission bus, only to further realize that as a passenger, I was taking up space badly needed by local people. But then the bus made a trip to the bush to do village evangelism. When we were almost at our destination, nearly 200 kilometers from the nearest service station, the bus blew a tire, and our trip came to an abrupt end. Our bus had no spare. Then and there, I discovered my niche. The national church here needed a spare tire, and I was willing to be one." There are those who suggest that the day of international mission is past. I do not believe this to be the case. The call and the command and the opportunity are still with us. The very nature of the church as a household or a family requires interaction. Indeed, I believe to be the people of God in all the fullness God intends, there need to be constant interaction and relationship between churches and congregations, not just in our county or country, but throughout the world. But there are new realities, and the experience of Jonier illustrates some directions for the practice of mission. One more story. Last September, the New Sudan Council of Churches, which coordinates all the work of the church in South Sudan, called their partner organizations together for a day to discuss their work and their interests in South Sudan. The donor agencies were all glad to come and give their reports and tell them what they wanted to do and how they were going to do it. The African churches waited for their turn, and then they reported their interests. And they were primarily interested in getting to know the agencies and to becoming friends with the people who staffed the agencies. The Western church concern was to do a job, in contrast with the local church's interest in developing friendship. And this highlights a significant rub in developing global church relationships. In this situation, how then do we practice mission? I assume spiritual and churchly commitment. I assume cultural sensitivity and linguistic skills. So let me just enumerate six themes which seem to me have to permeate the practice of mission, mission behavior in this new church order. First, the call to mission is a task for the church everywhere. Old distinctions between overseas and home mission mean less and less in this new church order. The base for mission is in God's love for the world and in a global church. All churches are in a process of sending and receiving. Second, the majority church of the South invites us to focus on relationships. Each participant in a congregation, in the church office, on location, should expect to be both a giver and a receiver. Exchange and mutual learning will be at the heart of mission practice. Mission is churches bearing with one another in the gospel. Thirdly, receiving missioners is as crucial as the sending of missioners. Missioners should expect to be assigned in their task on location rather than from an overseas office. Missioners should expect to see themselves as supplementary rather than integral to the work of the local church. Fourth, the entire world, including North America, is in a missionary situation. And the best training for an overseas missionary is for someone who has already practiced mission in his or her own culture. Fifth, missioners should see themselves as connectors, as facilitators for interchurch relations, including the obligation to come back to their sending church as being sent from their partner church. In MCC, when we send people overseas, we tell them in advance, 3 years down the road, you will be sent back here with a message and an assignment from the church you're going to be partnering with. Six, in a time of increasing estrangement between North and South, mission in the global church includes representing the other's point of view, promoting the sharing of global resources, and joining the struggle for peace and reconciliation. An important role that we have found in our organization is to work in mediation and conciliation, not primarily in the public and in the political sphere, but between church groups and within congregations who are suffering from division, both in North America and around the world. In discussing the practice of mission, it's worth underscoring the conspicuous difference in mood between our time and the story I told at the beginning of Reformed Mennonite cooperation in India. Those pioneer missionaries were not only inspired with missionary zeal, but they also went forth with the energies of a civilization on the march. Sectarian Mennonites, as well as establishment Reformed churches, were party to this religious-cultural alliance. The situation is now vastly different. The supporting props of mission, cultural, political, and economic, are disappearing. The church there, as well as here, is more and more an embattled minority. And the power of the church resides increasingly in its powerlessness. And so to conclude, the biblical vision of global mission is as real in 1995 as when the Gregorys went to Japan decades ago. Through their work and that of thousands of other faithful disciples, we now live with the great new fact of our time, a truly global church. This new reality, with all its weaknesses, and we can't forget Rwanda was a war between Christians. In spite of these weaknesses and sometimes conspicuous failures, this global church is nevertheless a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people. We are privileged people to live in this first epoch of the truly global church. And we carry great responsibility to rise to the occasion and become creative in our ecclesiology and our missiology. The model of Jesus is as relevant and inspiring for such a time as ever. Particularly in interchurch relations, I believe the biblical vision of the self-giving servant Messiah is especially relevant. Only as we take the form of a servant will we who have exercised power and aggressive leadership for centuries, will we be able to enter into the realm of world Christianity. This theme was expressed so well in the newsletter of St. Paul's Catholic Chapel in Nairobi last October. In a world that clutches at power, that seeks out positions of honor, that desires status even in the church, such a world is only trying to mask its own insecurity. Our world is brash and noisy and pompous precisely because it's unsure of itself, uncertain of where it is moving to. It makes a lot of noise because it tries to mask its sense of being lost. It makes a lot of noise because it's afraid of silence, afraid to think. Far too many people today have everything to live with and little, it seems, to live for. Such a world can only be touched by real service, by ministering in the form of a servant. And may God help us to that end.